Back to Radio Times. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a 7-2 ruling yesterday saying the Environmental Protection Agency has the right to force major stationary polluters, such as big power plants and factories, to reduce their CO2 emissions. On the other hand, the court said in a 5-4 decision, the agency could not regulate other lesser polluters like schools and businesses. This is a big week for the court that will be issuing much anticipated rulings before the end of the month, including ones involving abortion protests, contraception coverage, and cell phone searches. Our guest Lawrence Tribe has been a longtime and respected observer of the U.S. Supreme Court. He has argued some 35 cases before the court, including the first argument in Bush v. Gore. His new book, Uncertain Justice, written with Joshua Matz, takes us inside the John Roberts Court by analyzing the legal philosophies of the justices and their key rulings that are transforming the country. And Lawrence Tribe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
And I should add to our listeners, he's both a Harvard University professor and professor at Harvard Law School. Two of his students, President Barack Obama and Chief Justice John Roberts. I want to quote something that you wrote in the Philadelphia Inquirer today, and this is really a critique of the press coverage of the court, or perhaps the coverage of pundits. You say that in many ways the court gets reduced to caricature, and you write the justices are deemed liberals or conservatives or activists or originalists, and then flattened into simple stories that make them sound like crass politicians. In many articles, journalists make a point of emphasizing the political party of the president who appointed each justice, unsubtly hinting at where justices' true loyalties lie. You go on to say, in truth, the Roberts Court is a lively and fascinating place filled with intrigue, surprise, and reminders that reducing any justice to a cardboard cutout is an invitation to error, I should say. Is this something unique to the Roberts Court, or do you think this is what journalists just generally do when trying to understand court decisions?
Well, I guess journalists have done it for a long time, but there's much more focus on the court as the years go on, because people, first of all, have few other institutions in Washington to look at that are doing anything. Given the political paralysis, it's natural to kind of look at the institution that's making a difference in everybody's life in terms of guns, sex, videotapes, speech, equality, you name it. It's also the case that we've got a 24/7 news cycle, and that journalists have to compress things into sound bites in order to get any space in that news cycle. And given the pervasiveness of the news on the internet, probably there's even more flattening and simplification now. And finally, the divisions in the court are more open and visible now than they were earlier. If we get into it in our conversation, I'll talk about how the court, even when it looked unanimous in early years, was often internally divided 5-4, but the leader of the court, the Chief Justice, managed to herd the cats in such a way that they all looked like their tails were pointed the same way.
Well, in fact, you say, looking at Scalia and Alito, that while they're both called conservatives, they have really vigorous arguments with each other.
Vigorous battles, sometimes
with each other.
In the pages of the United States reports where the decisions are reported, sometimes on the bench. I mean, there was one case about violent video games being marketed to kids without the consent of their parents, and becoming quite impatient with Justice Scalia's comparisons to Hansel and Gretel. Justice Alito said, I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is, what did James Madison think of video games? Did he like them? And, you know, a little twisting of the screw. And that happens in cases about privacy and in other areas. So that quite often, when justices are thought of as part sort of peas in a pod, they're nothing like that. When Alito was actually named to the court, a lot of people said, oh, here comes Scalito. It's kind of a racial slur, an ethnic slur, but it couldn't be farther from the truth.
But do you think if the court, and I don't want to spend the whole hour on this because we've done a number of arguments about this, if the court were more open, if we could actually see the arguments, if we could see some of the, not the deliberations necessarily, but if the court were more open to outside intervention, if I can put it that way, do you think we would see them in a more nuanced way?
I think it would help. I think it would help a lot. People would see how serious and thoughtful they are. The questions are really intriguing and probing. And most of the arguments the justices have with one another, except in written memos, are conducted sort of by walking over the back of whichever lawyer is standing in front of them. They use the lawyer often as a kind of backboard to bounce things off one another. And I think it would help a great deal. Of course, nobody could make an argument for having the public sit in on their private deliberations in conference any more than the public has a right to listen when the president gets advice from the National Security Advisor. But beyond that, I think there is just no good case for limiting the access to the court the way it's now limited. I mean, right now, we all get to hear at least the voices of the justices. The tape recording of the argument is available sometimes the same day, but certainly the same week. And whoever is lucky enough to stand in line and in the rain from 4 in the morning gets to watch the argument. But it's a small courtroom. It's a kind of intimate conversational place. And as a result, the millions of people who would learn a great deal by listening to the arguments in any of the cases that you've mentioned and many others would learn a lot about how their government operates. The justices, though, are dead set against it. Even the ones who, during their confirmation hearings, say that they'd be open to it, tend to cherish their anonymity and the fact that the cameras are shut down while they speak in the court.
Are there adjectives to describe the Roberts Court, even though you say, you know, let's not put people in boxes, but from your perspective?
Oh, sure. Fascinating, interesting, deeply thoughtful, divided, uncertain of where it's going. The uncertainty theme, the title of the book, subtitle is The Roberts Court and the Constitution, but the title is Uncertain Justice. Living with that uncertainty, learning from it, deciding what it may mean, and deciphering the hidden signals that come out during the argument and in the opinions is a fascinating thing. And the court consists of 9 very smart people, much more uniform than some earlier courts. All 9 of them have been judges in the past, except for Elena Kagan.
Right.
None of them have really been politicians, unlike the Warren Court, which consisted of people who had been governor, attorney general, senator, head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. This court really doesn't have people with real political experience in the world. I think that's a great gap in the diversity of the court. And all 9 of them, by the way, have gone either to Harvard or Yale. Now, as you might imagine, I don't have anything against Harvard, or even, though this might surprise you, against Yale. But, you know, hey, what about the University of Pennsylvania? What about Berkeley? What about Kansas, the University of Texas? There are a lot of great places in this country and a lot of backgrounds that should be brought to bear. I mean, why do we have 9 justices rather than 1 supercomputer, you know, like the one that Deep Blue that could beat the world champion in chess?
Yikes, I never thought of that.
Well, the reason is that it's a human activity. It requires judgment. It requires experience. It requires getting a sense of what makes the world go round. And only lived experience can give people that, and different experiences lead you to see the same case differently and to read our history differently.
Well, I want to play a clip. I know this has probably haunted you on your book tour, but it's the clip of John Roberts during his confirmation hearings, where he makes the I guess it's a metaphor about judges being umpires. Let's listen.
Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules, but it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire.
So was he just being cute there, or was he telling us something?
He was being brilliant. It was great PR. It was an image that caught fire. I use a lot of baseball images in the book and a lot of baseball stories because we are a nation that loves baseball, and these are justices who love baseball and disagree about who are the greatest pitchers and who are the greatest teams. Like a good umpire, a judge is not supposed to call things in order to have his favorite team bring home the pennant. That much is true.
Right.
You're not supposed to bend whatever rules are clear. But unlike an umpire, the judges make rules. They make the rules of constitutional law. The Constitution is a very broad framework. That's why it's lasted a couple hundred years, with only 27 amendments. and it doesn't answer all the questions. In one of the talks I gave about the book, somebody came up afterwards and said, you may be interested to know that I am actually an umpire.
Oh, that's great.
And he pointed out to me one of the rules of baseball. It's rule 9.04C. It says, the umpire in chief shall have the authority to rule on any situation not covered in these rules.
Oh, and the Uber umpire.
The
right?
Uber umpire, like Uber, but worth more than the $4+ billion that Uber may be worth. That's really what the Roberts metaphor ignores, because most of the cases that are difficult enough to reach the Supreme Court and to require its attention can't be resolved by the lower courts are really hard. They involve clashes of values, parts of the Constitution whose meaning is not absolutely clear. Even when you say, I'm interested in what it originally meant, there are as many views of that as there were framers and ratifiers. And the historic meaning of even provisions like the clause giving the president power to make recess appointments, which the court will rule on either Wednesday or Thursday or maybe next Monday, there are conflicting views of what the history means and how much you should take account of the political dysfunction in an institution like the Senate.
How should we understand, or how do you understand, then, John Roberts' own constitutional philosophy? And it's something like 9 years of the John Roberts Court.
Right. Well, first of all, we know a lot more about Roberts than just those 9 years. It was many years ago that he was my student, and so I've had a sense of him for a long time. Brilliant lawyer, very good advocate. He knows how to frame an argument perfectly. He has a deep belief in a kind of libertarian view of the world, not pure libertarianism, but he's very much anti-coercion, which helps account for why he said that Congress doesn't have the power to coerce people into buying health insurance. Mm. But it has the power to nudge them that way by increasing their taxes, as long as it's not holding a gun to their head. And I thought that's what he would do. Most people didn't. But
and this is the Affordable Care Act.
In the Affordable Care Act. I mean, both before the oral argument and after, I was on a lot of TV stations saying, I think Roberts will cast a decisive vote to uphold the individual mandate. But he'll do it by treating it not as a mandate, but as a kind of tax. Right. And Rush Limbaugh said I should be institutionalized. I had to be crazy. But it turns out that is what the court did.
I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation because I want to dig a little bit deeper into that. Our guest is Lawrence Tribe. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, also university professor at Harvard, and John Roberts, one of his students, as was Barack Obama. And he's got a new book. It's called Uncertain Justice, and it's subtitled The Roberts Court and the Constitution. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation talking about the Affordable Care Act and Chief Justice John Roberts' vote on that act. We also are going to open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499 for any questions you might have about the Roberts Court. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY FX Networks, presenting the new original series, Tyrant, from the producers of 24 and Homeland. Tyrant premieres tonight at 10, only on FX. More at fxnetworks.com.
17 miles each way.
3 round trips, it's going to be a 12-hour day.
7 days a week.
Extend your stay, take a trip across the bay.
365 days a year.
Winds up to 45, 50 miles an hour. Yeah, brutal.
For 5 decades.
Thank you for taking a break from the ordinary.
A WHYY original production. Billion Mile Journey, the Cape May Lewis Ferry. Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY TV.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Burnaby Volvo in Huntington Valley supports WHYY. Burnaby Volvo's Wonder of Summer event is going on now, featuring a variety of new models. Wonder of Summer details and full inventory at burnabyvolvo.com, 215-947-6363.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Lawrence Tribe about his new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And we've been talking about Chief Justice Roberts' ruling or his vote on the Affordable Care Act, essentially upholding what? Upholding the mandate.
Upholding the mandate by saying it's not really a mandate. It's just it's an alternative. It says you either buy insurance, or if you choose not to, under the law, as written, they can't put you in jail. All they can do is increase your taxes to help offset the burden that you're likely to impose on taxpayers and on other insured people when you go to the emergency room and can't pay for the service that you get free under another federal law. So he basically upheld it by saying it's not what it seems.
Yes. But it's so interesting. I mean, he was really pounced. I mean, critics of the Affordable Care Act and President Obama as well just pounced on him for his decision.
Well, President Obama praised it. President Obama did, yes. Yeah. And he praised it partly because he, like some of the more progressive members of the court, like Justice Kagan, who also, by the way, was a research assistant of mine at a different time from the president, and Justice Breyer, when the court, 7-2, with those people who are typically called liberal joining the Chief Justice and the real conservatives on the court, struck down the rule that Congress had attempted to promulgate that would force states to accept enlarged Medicaid paid for by the federal government in large part. They struck that down. They said you can't hold a gun to the head of a state either. That is, it's an anti-coercion court. And Obama and a number of liberals didn't pay much attention to that. They thought, the states are going to voluntarily sign up. Well, little did they know that a fair number of states, ideologically driven, would deprive their own poorest citizens, I think rather outrageously, of the benefits of federally paid for Medicaid. And as a result, even though the rollout is no longer the problem with Obamacare, there are terrible difficulties with getting large enough coverage of the people who need it most because of the court's other holding on the Medicaid side.
Do you think some of the, including Kagan, do you think some of the justices regret their ruling? Is there any way to know that?
Well, I know her well, but I don't think either she or I would think it appropriate for us to have a conversation about that.
Right.
I have a feeling she was a little surprised, and probably Steve Breyer as well. I think they thought, this is almost a free vote. That is, we can go along. The Chief Justice has 5 votes for this holding anyway. Make it 7-2 and make it clear to the guy that we appreciate the way he used his legal skills to figure out how to uphold the individual mandate. And I think there were some other explanations that I try to give in the book at a human and legal level of why they voted the way they did, but I have a feeling they didn't predict this outcome.
Well, you write the chief's vote to uphold the Affordable Care Act will go down as one of the most consequential acts of his tenure on the court and one of the most controversial.
I think that's almost
2 years now.
And I think he's bound to be there, you know, we hope, for another 30 years or something, given life expectancies. And I think when it's all over, people will still say this was one of the most important things he did, partly because it represents a clash between over a century of aspirations by people, sometimes on the Republican side of the aisle as well, certainly Theodore Roosevelt and others who tried to get universal health care. Finally, something like it is passed, and for the court to have struck it down would have been a thunderbolt of the first order. And I think finding a legally sound way to avoid that consequence was an achievement of the Roberts Court.
Let's take the issue of affirmative action and look at Sotomayor, how she views affirmative action and how Thomas views that. And help us understand how perhaps their backgrounds and certainly some of their judicial philosophy influences how they look at this issue.
Right. Well, affirmative action has been deeply controversial ever since it hit the national radar screen long, long ago in the Bakke case. That is, it became clear in Brown v. Board of Education, which was controversial in its time, with lots of billboards saying impeach Earl Warren. It was clear then that you couldn't use race to put minorities down, to effectively say that they're not good enough to mingle with whites in our schools. But if you use someone's race to take account of the problems they've faced and to get past a racial history of terrible Jim Crow laws and slavery, and to get into the future with greater integration and diversity, some of the more liberal justices say that's different. It's completely different. We should be much more willing to let the political process do that. But there are four justices, led by Roberts, who take the position that basically we've solved the problem that Brown v. Board was designed to solve and that the Equal Protection Clause was designed to solve. We've gotten rid of official discrimination against racial minorities. Now we have to just go forward, and the best way to end discrimination based on race is to stop discriminating based on race, what they call reverse discrimination. Four justices say, we're not nearly there yet. That's why the subtitle of my equality chapter is, Are We There Yet?
Yes.
Four justices say, we're not there yet. We have miles to go before we sleep. Justice Kennedy is in the middle. He's torn. He sees truth on both sides. The most powerful voices on both sides are Sotomayor, in favor of the view, we're not there yet, we have a lot more to do, and Thomas, in favor of the view that you shouldn't do supposed favors for minorities, because not only will a lot of whites resent it, but minorities will feel stigmatized. And they both talk passionately, both on and off the court, about the way they have felt when they were benefited by virtue of their race. They both see that they got where they are, partly because people became more inclusive and put a thumb on the scale for their race. They both know they're super smart. They both know that they deserve to be where they are. They both believe it. And yet Thomas says, wherever I go, people look at me and say, that guy's there only because he's black. And you're not really doing me or my brothers any favors. Sotomayor says, you don't have to see it that way. I know that I mightn't be here, probably wouldn't be here if I were not a Latina, but I don't let that make me feel inferior. I use it to challenge me to be as excellent as I can. Now, there are differences going all the way back to their childhood, and I don't engage in armchair psychoanalysis in the book, but you can see that looking at the world through those different lenses, you're going to have a different view of what equal protection of the laws means. And you're not going to find the answer to that question in the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. My God, when the 14th Amendment was written, the people who wrote it thought segregated schools were just fine.
Exactly.
They didn't deny anyone equal protection of the laws. They treated blacks and whites equally. They told them both, stay away from each other.
Getting back, though, to Robert's quote, then it isn't really balls and strikes, because people bring their own experience. I mean, they have to bring their own experience to the court.
Inevitably. And in fact, there was one famous umpire who once said that the strike zone is a living, breathing document. That is, even when they're not making up rules, as justices need to, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder, in part, where the strike zone is.
How do you understand Justice Thomas? And I mean, so much has been written about how quiet he is on the court, that he rarely asks or maybe has never asked a question.
No, never is too strong. I did one argument, and the argument right before mine, he asked a question.
Okay.
And he asked a question of the other side in a case that I was arguing.
Okay.
And it was a damn good question.
But how do you see him on the court? Because there's...
Well, I know a lot of people criticize his silence. The other eight are so voluble that you can barely get half a word in before somebody... I was going to say interrupts you, but it's not exactly an interruption. You want to know what's on the justices' minds when you're arguing one of these cases. And he asks nothing, almost always. His explanation is, maybe it's my Southern upbringing. I was brought up to believe that when people talk, you should listen. And some people say that's a little simplistic. But I, first of all, think that does reflect his personality. I've gotten to know him a little. That's the way he seems to think. He thinks that there are more than enough questions from the other eight to inform him of what he needs to know after having read all the briefs. And he would really like not to pile on even further. Now, it may be that once you get into that habit, it's hard to break. It's you know, you, the first time, it's like when you fail to invite somebody to a party and you fail the next year and the next year.
At
some
point,
soon, you worry it's going to stick out like a sore thumb the first time you do. And I know that he's not all that eager to have headlines in the New York Times. Clarence Thomas asks question. A combination of things, but I can't get completely inside his head. I just know that he understands what's going on very thoroughly, and he's a very smart justice. He's not just like Scalia. In fact, he's considerably more dedicated to the original meaning of the Constitution. In one place in the book, I note that Scalia once said, clearly referring to Thomas, "I may be an originalist, but I'm not a nut."
Oh,
it was,
ouch.
Ouch is
why
right.
Why does he talk that way, Scalia? Well, he seems so personal.
He does. I think he gets off on saying what's on his mind.
Yeah.
And he often writes what's on his mind.
Clearly.
It helps the public understand what's on his mind. And so I don't criticize him for it, although I'm not sure purely as a matter of tactics that it's the best way to be influential on a multi-member body where you have to get along with each other. They do get along, though. I mean, for example, he and Ginsburg, though they very often disagree in cases, not always, but often, go to the opera together. They're best friends, they're best buddies. They both sometimes give speeches sort of back-to-back about the future of technology and how the court will have to grapple with the Edward Snowden revelations and with NASA data mining and metadata mining. Scalia says, "I kind of lament that. We don't know anything about technology. That we're the last branch who should be heard from." Ginsburg says, "No, the fact that we're not mired in those technical details gives us an advantage. We can be serious about the constitutional principles and not get distracted by all the techno-wizardry that's available." So they see the world differently, but they're buddies.
Kind of like James Madison playing video games, right?
That's right.
Lawrence Tribe is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the Roberts Court, the subject of his new book called Uncertain Justice. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We have a tweet from Joe. It seems that some justices build their arguments to support their beliefs. Is that right?
Well, if by beliefs you mean their beliefs about
maybe preconceived ideas?
Everybody has preconceived ideas. Justice Scalia once said that if you came to the court as a blank slate, that would prove you were disqualified. Anybody who's had enough thought, study, experience with the law and the Constitution, who by the time they get to the court hasn't formed some inclinations about, you know, what liberty means, how important the rights of the states are, has got to be fooling either herself or himself or us. But if by beliefs you mean beliefs about, oh, this is a good big business, it should win, and I'll find a legal way to do it, that would be wrong, but I don't really think that's the way justices act.
Well, let me pick up on that with the Citizens United decision, which has been criticized by the president. You seem to indicate that the court was saying, we don't trust Congress to be able to kind of handle this issue about who gets to decide or who should govern.
Or who should speak.
Or who
should speak,
and
how much. I mean, that really is the point. A lot of people, I think, miss the point of Citizens United. Forget that it dealt with unions as well as corporations. Forget that the result would have been exactly the same if it had involved not an anti-Hillary Clinton documentary, as that case did, but an anti-Sarah Palin documentary. And forget the fact that the court was not saying anything about the special rights of corporations. It was saying something about the special protection of speech, regardless of what or who the speaker is, from the government. It's a kind of anti-government decision more than a pro-corporation decision. They don't trust the government. Their view is that the First Amendment is about not trusting the government to orchestrate and balance the set of voices that influence voters in the electorate.
But one of the critiques is that if we're talking about corporations or even unions, we're talking about people who have a lot of money.
Right.
And they have money that they can use to influence Congress influence votes. And this idea is that the more money you have, the more speech you have. Isn't that been one of the results of Citizens United?
Well, it's perhaps to some degree, but when Eric Cantor loses to his opponent, even though he outspends his opponent 20-1, that reminds us that money is not directly translated into persuasiveness and into electoral results. But at least we make some progress if we realize that Citizens United is not about the influence of corporations as such. It's about the influence of money.
Mm.
And I think the court underestimated how troublesome it is that wealth translates not into direct votes and bribery, but that it does translate into influence and access. I mean, clearly the people who bundle a whole bunch of money for Barack Obama or for a Republican are more likely to get, you know, at the extreme an ambassadorship, and down the line they're more likely to get their emails answered when they email a White House staffer. That's unfortunate, but nobody that I have seen, certainly nobody who's written an amendment to deal with Citizens United, a possible constitutional amendment, has come up with a solution that makes any sense. I mean, certainly nobody, at least nobody I know, wants to say that if you've got a lot of money, you can't spend it on a politically dramatic attack on a particular politician or a particularly dramatic defense of a politician. We wouldn't want to say that an organization, be it corporate or otherwise, couldn't spend lots and lots of money on an anti-Hillary book in the next election or an anti some Republican book.
But at the same time, and I'm no legal scholar, that will become very apparent here, but it does create unequal levels of speech. And
that
just,
is scary. That is
right,
scary.
Right, so just even regular people.
Right. I mean, think about another kind of example. I know it's far-fetched, but I used to love science fiction when I was a kid. Suppose some spaceship with lots of access to money lands here, you know, and they start broadcasting messages, and the government says, geez, these messages are really powerful, and these ET guys manage somehow to get Chase Manhattan and Citibank to give them a lot of dough. We don't want them to speak so much, so we're going to make it improper for them to speak. I think that would raise serious First Amendment problems, and one of the things I criticize the court for is ducking the issue of the limits that we now have on foreigners spending money to influence American elections. I mean, that was actually the issue that caused the little dust-up between President Obama and Justice Alito during the State of the Union message. It was when Obama said that under Citizens United, foreigners can influence our elections, that Alito shook his head and said under his breath, not true. Well, the fact is, it may not have been true because a lower court, which the U.S. Supreme Court upheld without giving any explanation, a lower court held that the act of Congress which prevents foreigners from influencing our policy on immigration or anything else is just fine.
That's Lawrence Tribe, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our calls, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, The Man presents Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra Friday, June 27th at 8 p.m. Bramwell Tovey leads the orchestra with Wolf Trap opera artists and special guests the Choral Arts Society of Washington. Also on the program, Beethoven's Overture to Egmont and Benjamin Britten's 4C interludes from Peter Grimes. Tickets for all Man shows are available by phone at 800-745-3000 or online at mancenter.org.
When you sell your soul, it opens a deep, dark hole. When you sell your soul, it opens a deep, dark hole.
That's Mary Gaucher from her new album, Trouble and Love. On the next Fresh Air, she performs autobiographical songs in our studio. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's going to be a busy few days for the U.S. Supreme Court with the release of a number of key rulings before the end of their session. Our guest, Lawrence Tribe, has been tracking the court for years. He's an authority on the U.S. Constitution. He taught two famous graduates of Harvard Law School, President Barack Obama, and Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts. Tribe is the author of this new book we're talking about called Uncertain Justice, about decisions made during the 9 years of the Roberts Court. He's speaking tonight at the National Constitution Center. I am told the event is sold out. They will be live streaming his talk, so you can certainly listen in the comfort of your own home or your office. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, talking about understanding the Roberts Court, understanding the workings of the U.S. Supreme Court. Let me get Robert from media to join us. Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi, great show. Professor
Thank you.
Tribe, I was wondering, and I'll take my call up and talk to you. I noticed the other day that public opinion had the support for the Supreme Court down to historic lows, 30%, I think the figure was. And I'm wondering to what extent the court is concerned with its own legitimacy, that is, the public sense. I mean, you know, people seem to feel almost these days that you can handicap a decision based on the politics of the justices, and I'm wondering if that issue ever surfaces in their decisions. I know you hinted at it earlier about the healthcare decision, but that to what extent are the justices themselves concerned about the flagging belief in the court as an institution, and does that ever pop into opinions, do you think, or is that something they just don't concern themselves with?
Robert, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Well, you know, the answer to any of those questions is probably nine different things depending on which justice you're talking about. I know some of the justices couldn't care less. That is, they think it's their job to interpret the Constitution, vague though it sometimes is, as best they can and let the chips fall where they may. And there are justices that you would, I think, believe are on the right and on the left who think that. Justices Ginsburg and Breyer have recently made public speeches in which they have lamented the way the court is depicted as increasingly political. And they've said things that suggest that they think some of those depictions may be right. Now, I don't happen to agree with the second part. I think the court is not driven by partisan politics. It's driven by different political constitutional philosophies. I mean, the Constitution is a political document. Issues about the limits of government power versus liberty, the meaning of equality, the balance between the federal government and the states, those are legal in a sense, but they're also deep political questions in our history. But when you look at the popularity or unpopularity of the court, it's had almost nothing to do with whether they are 5-4 or anything like that. I mean, Dred Scott, probably the most infamous decision in our history, saying that African Americans didn't deserve to be citizens and striking down the Missouri Compromise, triggering the Civil War. That was a 7-2 decision. Although Brown v. Board was 9-0, it wasn't popular at the time. Lots of people thought Earl Warren was simply making up the law. Lots of people wanted to impeach him. It turns out that it was originally 5-4 the other way until Chief Justice Vinson died. And in a communication that he never really made public, Felix Frankfurter, who was on the court, said at the time, the replacement of Vincent by Warren is one of the few things that has ever really convinced me that God exists. So I think the bottom line is the justices, I think, are probably too smart to think that political acceptability in the short run matters a lot. They do know that as an institution, they need respect. That is, they need public support, because they have no army, they have no power to raise money. If they for too long were too out of step with what the people believed on something, that would be problematic. And so at some level, conscious or unconscious, I think the justices are aware that they can't get so disconnected from popular opinion that they are completely off the charts. But popular opinion is itself deeply divided on issues like abortion, affirmative action, guns. I mean, people who think that there is a center of American opinion on these issues, I don't think understand how America is a history of deep division and dialogue. Only rarely, thank God, does it break into war, a civil war. But even when it doesn't break into war, it breaks into impolite screaming matches across the chasm, and the court has to negotiate all of those chasms.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kind of a related follow-up. This is a Facebook comment from Paul. He says, I think the Supreme Court is in many cases as polarized as the whole country. Do you see, I mean, it's a body of people with strong opinions that sometimes agree and sometimes disagree.
Yeah, and it would be hard to expect it to be much less polarized than the rest of the country. I mean, there are things that unify it. They all are devoted to the Constitution. But the Constitution means different things to different people, including different justices. And the degree of polarization, contrary to a lot of the journalistic accounts, hasn't gotten greater in this era of polarized politics. I mean, the Roberts Court in the period from 2005 to last year has had about 20.1% of its cases decided 5-4. And of those, only a third look like they're along political lines. Two-thirds don't. The Rehnquist Court was about 20% instead of 20.1%, 5-4. I mean, it's not a sudden increase. There was a dramatic increase early in the court's history when an academic guy got it into the chief justiceship. It was Harlan Fiske Stone, who had been dean of Columbia Law School. And unlike some of his predecessors, like William Howard Taft, who wanted to present a unanimous face to the country, he said, oh, why do that? We're all better off if the justices have their individual say. We're often 5-4, but we cover it up.
Hmm.
And let's let it all hang out. And at that point, there started to be a climb in separate opinions and 5-4 opinions. So ironically, the court is being more political when it covers up internal division and tries to present a unanimous face to the public for reasons of acceptability and persuasion, as it finally did in Brown v. Board.
Let me pick up on something you said earlier. Do you think the fact that the Congress has such a hard time these days writing laws and coming to some kind of consensus, that has empowered the U.S. Supreme Court, given them more authority in this country?
Well, it certainly gives them more attention.
Yes.
And authority to some extent follows attention. I don't think it makes what they do legitimate if it wouldn't otherwise have been legitimate. We'll test that a little bit in how the court reasons about the recess appointment power. Because despite the recent filibuster reform, the time will again come when the president and the Senate are in different political hands, and it won't take a filibuster to stop the president from making important appointments to fill agencies and to fill even lower court slots. And at that point, if the president has as little recess appointment power as a literal reading of the text of the Constitution might give him, that would mean that paralysis in the Senate is translated into paralysis of the whole government. And whether the court would or should take that into account and how it reads this historic document is going to be a very interesting question. I suspect some justices are going to be writing in that case, a case called NLRB v. Noel Canning. Will be writing in that case that you need to understand the Constitution in light of what our politics has become. And others will say we can't pay attention to that.
Let me get looks like Carol from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call,
You're
Marty.
Welcome. Sure.
My question is, should there be a mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices? I feel like this whole conversation of I'm going to wait until this president is in office or a president that I like is in office before I retire, it makes it more political to me, and I just think there should be a mandatory retirement age.
Thanks, Carol. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I agree with part of your concern, Carol. I think a different solution that might be even better is to make it a fixed 18-year term, non-renewable. And various people have proposed doing something like that. A mandatory retirement age is a little arbitrary. it might lead, you know, to the appointment of people who otherwise wouldn't be appointed and so on. And mandatory retirement ages completely overlook the fact that some people in their 70s are a lot more spry and with it than other people in their 50s. It seems to me, though, that if we had a non-renewable 18-year term rather than these long terms that were, you know, for life invented at a time when people died much younger, it might be better. And it might be better, too, if we set it up so that every president gets an average of 2 appointments in a 4-year term. I mean, I think that could be worked out mathematically, and it might improve the system. It would, most people think it would take a constitutional amendment to do that, and the constitutional amendment is enormously hard to get. You know, you need 2/3 of the House and 2/3 of the Senate and 3/4 of the state legislatures. Some people have suggested a way of getting around the Constitution's provision about life tenure without an amendment, saying that it guarantees you life tenure as a judge, but not on any particular court. So the idea would be that you could pass a statute that would say that after 18 years, the justice can serve in various lower federal courts, the way Justice O'Connor does now, the way Justice Souter does now, but no longer in the U.S. Supreme Court unless they're needed there because of recusals.
A little workaround, I guess.
A workaround, right.
Carol, thanks for the call. Let me see what Rick from Warminster has to say. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. The question about the justices themselves and their freedom of expression and their privacy. For example, are they precluded or is the media precluded from finding out whether they how they registered as a Republican or Democrat on their IRS forms and tax forms, that they contribute to a particular 501c, et cetera? Are there certain prohibitions on how information relative to their jobs is kept from the public?
Rick, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Good question. Yep. Good question, Rick. The IRS data, as some of the current, you know, flubbubs about the IRS have made clear, are supposedly secret. Now, I imagine the NSA may know everything. But setting that aside, what the IRS knows about each of us, whether we are a Supreme Court justice or an auto mechanic or a law professor, is not fair game. I don't think justices should have any more protection from background probing than anyone else, but I don't think they should have less protection either. They do, by the way, care a lot about their privacy. And one of the arguments I discuss in the book, the argument about the FBI attaching a GPS to the underbelly of a Jeep, the Chief Justice asked the lawyer for the government, do you mean to say, when you say that this is not a search subject to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, that they could put a GPS under my car and follow me around for 30 days? Now, that put the lawyer in quite a bind. What is he going to say? No, your excellency, you're different? So the answer had to be yes. And from then on, it was clear that the case would come out against the government. What was not clear, and that's true of a lot of 9-to-nothing decisions, as that one was, is what the rationale would be. And that tells us more about the future in things like the cell phones case than just the fact that they all voted that this was a search. Some of the justices, like Scalia, said that what makes this a search is that they are violating your property. And back in 1791, we knew that one of the things the Fourth Amendment protects is your property, right? Alito, again disagreeing with Scalia, said that's not what makes it a search. It's that they're violating your expectations of privacy. What difference would it make if the GPS was not on the car but following you from a distance? And there was a great back and forth between Scalia and Alito that generated.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And just picking up on that, on a related issue, of course, is the NSA surveillance. Is this an issue that's going to eventually, you think, make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Marty, I'm sure it will. I mean,
for all the reasons that you've probably just said, plus more.
Yeah, and in particular, until Edward Snowden's revelations, it was hard for anybody to prove that they were the subject of metadata collection. You know, that the government had data showing when they went to see a divorce lawyer, when they went to visit some possible girlfriend or boyfriend 3 times a week, when they went to the shrink's office. Nobody could really prove that the government had that information. Now we know the government at least has, though we don't know how often it accesses it,
right,
that information on all of us, because it follows the information about whom we email and which websites we visit and where we are with our cell phones. And that will be affected partly by that cell phone decision. But now that everyone can prove it, it's not going to be hard for someone to get what is called standing to challenge that program, and it will definitely reach the court within the next couple of years.
You, as I said several times, taught both Barack Obama and John Roberts at Harvard Law School.
And let's not forget Elena Kagan.
She
was a terrific research assistant of mine, and I know her even better than I know either of them, I think.
But were they three students that you said to yourself, man, they're going places?
No question. I didn't know which places,
but
I knew that there was no ceiling on what they could reach.
In what way? I mean, just the way their minds work?
They were brilliant. They were thoughtful. They were incredibly hardworking. They had really good judgment. I thought they would all be politically effective, and all of that was true.
Well, Lawrence Tribe, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you, Marty.
It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, our guest, Lawrence Tribe, author of this new book that we've been talking about called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And he is speaking tonight at a sold-out event, I'm told, at the National Constitution Center across from here at WHYY. And the talk will be live-streamed. I believe it starts at something like 6:30.
I think so
as well. Go to WHY. Yes, I got thumbs up. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. We posted a photograph of our guest Lawrence Tribe on our Facebook page. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.